Hi, everyone. So I'm Sonali Roy. I've been at RNID for about 15 years. Been working on accessible media. So if you've got any complaints about accessible media, just come find me after this. So I work on access to media, culture, and immersive technologies. Thanks for joining. I think it's been a great conference. I don't think I've attended any other conference where audio description has been mentioned as much, I mean, except for the dedicated audio description conferences. So it's definitely been great. So we'll be talking about work-life balance. We're talking about leisure. But I think those of us who've been working since before the pandemic, we know the world of work has changed. You know, it looks different, it feels different. The pandemic really shook things up. And with that shift, the leisure has taken on a whole new role. It's available in a lot of more exciting ways on new digital platforms. People are engaging with it in very different social settings, and it has a different meaning at the moment. So this afternoon, I've got a panel that's about exploring this shift, looking at multiple perspectives. Obviously, we've got people who are creating these experiences, and you know they're almost behind the camera, making sure that everything runs smoothly. But at the heart of our discussion is inclusive design, making sure that the end user, people with lived experience, are at the very core of all discussions. So with that thought in mind, let's start with some introductions. And I want to start with John, because John, I think you had a really good weekend. Any Celtic fans
makes
here?
A change.
No, John, I think you're good to go.
Does it makes a stay, makes a change. Can you hear me? Yeah, we did have a good weekend. I'm expecting some booze. No, none. Yeah, okay. Want me just to introduce myself? I'm John Spears. I'm the Disability Access Officer for Rangers Football Club. I kind of oversee all of the services that the club provides to support disabled people and accessing, mainly football matches, but also any of the other services around tours, any other activities that the club's involved in. This includes, you know, as you can imagine, the physical nature of the stadium in relation to things like wheelchairs. We have over 150 wheelchair accessible spaces, neurodiverse space, which won the UEFA Best Award 2023 sensory room, just setting up a deaf supporters group, and we also have a group called the Rex Blind Party, which have been in place for over 50 years, which provide 25 season tickets to people with visual impairments and 25 companion seats. And they're provided with audio descriptive commentary from four fantastic people who have been doing it for over 30 years and are about 100 times better than the TV commentators. So that's well established, and I'm just really interested in learning more about how we make our services more accessible to all supporters, specifically people with visual impairments, and fascinated to hear all the innovation and digital aspect, artificial intelligence and technology that's been talked about today. It's been brilliant.
Great. Thank you, John. Natalie, do you want to go next?
So I'm Natalie Curran. I'm here from the BBC. And I think for doing self-descriptions, wearing a grey skirt, black top, and a grey, black and white patterned jacket with funky silver sequins all over it. that's me.
Thanks, Natalie. Ellie?
Hi, I'm Ellie. I'm the project lead of the TV Access Project, which is an alliance of the 10 largest broadcasters and streamers in the UK who have pledged to work together to make the TV industry fully accessible by 2030. I'm a white woman with shoulder-length curly hair, and I'm wearing a green shirt dress.
Thank you, Ellie. I love these targets by 2030.
Yes, yeah, we've got 5 years to go, so no pressure. the really special thing about the TV Access Project, it was mentioned on the last panel, it's so collaborative. Actually, Natalie and Jonathan are both involved in our work, There's no gatekeeping. We're all working towards a really, really important shared goal.
Thank you. Jonathan?
Sure. Hi. Thanks, everyone. Really good to be here. My name is Jonathan Penny. I'm the Access Services Manager for Channel 4. So working at the kind of opposite end of TV compared to Ellie, like we're very much, my role is very much involved in like how audiences at home access our programmes. So, you know, a range of different things, like Alan alluded to in the introduction to the session as well, like audio description, you know, most relevant for the audience today, but looking at all different ways of ensuring that whatever the programme is that we're making and whatever's the sort of high-profile show of the month or year, that we're doing everything we can to enhance that, both in terms of, you know, and there's some things we can talk about later about making the core bit of the programme itself kind of more inclusive and you know, inclusive by design and inherently accessible, but also I think fortunate in the UK to have like quite a mature set of you know, targets and quotas and regulation around what's added to the programme to make it kind of go the extra mile and be accessible for everyone as well. And I'm based here in Glasgow, so it's very nice to have a conference on home turf as well. I'm a white guy with dark hair in my, I think I used to say early 30s, I'm going to have to start saying mid-30s now, I think. But yeah, and I'm wearing a jazzy patterned shirt.
Thank you. Fun fact for everyone. So last year we had about 350,000 hours of audio described content on linear television. That was 2024. So it sounds like quite a bit, because there's a lot more that you can do, not just Channel 4, not just speaking on you. Lindsay, over to you.
Yeah, I'm Dr. Lindsay Shepherd. I'm a reader in cybersecurity and human computer interaction from Abertay University up in Dundee. I'm wearing a grey cardigan, blue jeans, 5'4 with slightly messy blonde hair. And the reason I'm here is from the gaming perspective. So we at Abertay have been working with the RNIB on and off over the last few years, most recently on a project around making VR and immersive experiences a bit more accessible, because we're seeing these being rolled out to the likes of museums, and everybody needs to be able to access these.
Thank you, Lindsay. I realise I haven't done a self-description, so I'm sure you can tell from my accent, Indian heritage, so brown skin, dark short hair, wearing a black dress, brown boots, green jacket. And I mean, because audio description is subjective, I'll say I'm quite tall. I'm the tallest woman in my family. I'm 5'1". That 1 inch is really important. Let's start with the questions. I'm going to come to you, Jonathan, first, because TV is my favourite. I know we've talked about audio description, but this, I think we're talking about accessibility a lot more when we're talking about the broadcast industry. There's a new role, you know, that accessibility coordinator role. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so an access coordinator is I think something that's maybe started in Europe. I think there were a lot of people with this role like originally in Spain, and it's something that kind of more TV productions are using in the UK now, and it's basically someone who is involved in the production, so like not my end of, you know, once the program's delivered and you know, getting ready to go out on TV, but very much in the thick of when it's being made, and they're the kind of I guess the point person for any access requirements that cast and crew, you know, might have during that production phase. And I think, you know, it's something that Channel 4, you know, unlike some of the broadcasters, work with a lot of different independent production companies. We don't have any sort of in-house production at the moment. And we've started to see, you know, a range of different like programs that we're working with will have someone who's maybe, you know, if there's an obvious example is like if there's a blind or a deaf person in the cast of, or, you know, as a contributor to a program, they're becoming a sort of a point of contact, I suppose, for between the production team and whoever it is in the channel, whether that's in the commissioning team or, you know, even people in my sort of area of thinking about how that programme's made accessible for viewers as well. And I'll maybe talk about a couple of examples of where, you know, where I've seen that role kind of interacting with my work. We had a, you know, I was talking with Ellie about it the other week, an episode of Love It or List It, which is a property format show that we make, where there was a deaf BSL-using couple featured in one of the episodes. They were living in, I think, a kind of, you know, terraced, like a townhouse, like lots of different levels. And they basically, you know, they're both BSL users. They wanted to move somewhere that was more, you know, a bit more open plan. They could kind of exist in, you know, basically a more deaf-friendly house, I suppose. You know, they wanted to, they didn't want to have to be running up and downstairs all the time, you know, trying to communicate with each other. They wanted to have a kind of open space, open plan space where they could communicate with each other more easily without being in different rooms and not able to kind of sign to each other. So that show came with a lot of, you know, a lot of interpreter needs, you know, in terms of British Sign Language on set between the those contributors and the talent and the crew as well, but also kind of some practical, you know, I was going to say challenges, I don't want to say challenges, I mean practical reasons to do things differently to how they might ordinarily have been done in terms of how, you know, a trope of that kind of show is like, you know, someone's giving an interview, like while I'm talking right now, and over the top of that, they'll show images or footage of different things. You know, we've all experienced that in TV programmes, but obviously that doesn't work when the people being interviewed are using British Sign Language. So things like that, like making sure that they, while they're being filmed, they're actually remaining in vision so that someone at home who's watching them and also uses sign language can kind of appreciate their, you know, their contribution to the programme, rather than just hearing the kind of the, you know, the dubbing or the voiceover or reading the subtitle, but actually experiencing it in the way that they, you know, contribute it to the show. All of which is a roundabout way of saying, yes, there are more access coordinators now in UK kind of TV production, and I think it's a really useful kind of link or pivot, I guess, between, you know, what's happening on set and how, you know, that environment is becoming more inclusive for, you know, cast and crew as well with disabilities, but also being a really useful link for people at my end of the sort of, you know, very post-production to have that kind of insight into what's kind of coming down the road as well.
Thank you. That's really interesting. I think representation, I think it's fairly new, so we've always talked about accessibility and mostly on-screen accessibility. We've stuck with audio description for many years. But everything that's happening recently, I mean, Chris McCausland winning Strictly was a big moment. And that's happened because certain systems are now becoming more accessible. Have you noticed some change, you know, working within the TV Access Project? Because you're working with lots of different broadcasters, Ellie. How are the broadcasters responding to it? And what are the challenges?
Yeah, so really how TAP, the TV Access Project, was born was Jack Thorne, a screenwriter. He's had two big Netflix shows out in the past couple of weeks, Adolescence and Toxic Town. Absolutely brilliant screenwriter who's been around for a long time. And he was asked to give a lecture at the Edinburgh TV Festival where he said the TV industry has failed disabled people. There's a very, very small group of disabled people telling these stories. And he wanted to be able to hand over to the next group of disabled people. So we've seen this massive shift in behind-the-screen talent and therefore what you see on screen. So the more disabled people you have working behind the camera, the more inclusive content, the more representative stories, the kind of richer content that we as viewers get to enjoy. So there has been a huge shift. You know, a programme like Love It or List It, I don't think would have happened 5 years ago. We probably would have gone, oh, it's a bit too complicated. But now it's celebrated, And we want more of those stories, and we're really trying to find more of those stories as well. So, yeah, we have seen a huge shift. And as I said before, the brilliant thing about it being a coalition, so our members are the BBC, ITV, Channel 4, Channel 5, UK TV, Sky, STV, Amazon, Disney and BritBox. That we're all kind of pushing each other as well. No one wants to be left behind. So we're all on this journey together. And they all want to be telling the best stories. So, yeah, it's about kind of keeping people accountable.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, recently I found out about this new authoring tool, an audio description authoring tool, which is fully accessible for screen reader users. That never happened. But because we now have blind AD reviewers, they've had to make that software accessible. So, yes, I think that involvement engagement is really important. Just sticking with the broadcasting industry, Natalie, if I can come to you next.
Yeah.
So BBC is obviously massive. It's led the way in accessibility on a number of different fronts. But what about the systems that the BBC designs or procures? How do you ensure that they're accessible for staff with disabilities or staff with sight loss?
Yeah, so I probably should have said in my intro, so I'll try and be brief, I think I kept it too brief. So I'm an accessibility specialist with the internal accessibility team. So we look after kind of staff-facing products and systems, because it's all very well wanting to support more on-screen talent with disabilities or make it more accessible for the end user, as we've talked a lot about in this conference. But we forget sometimes your staff and employees can be your end user as well. So the BBC is, obviously, it's the national broadcaster and it wants to reflect the country as it is. So there are people with disabilities in the general population, so therefore there should be, and we'd expect there to be, in staff. But it's all very well recruiting staff with disabilities, but if your systems aren't accessible, then they're not going to stay very long. So we do, our team is growing, actually. It's one of the few areas that is growing, because there's a real recognition that accessibility matters. So for the really big things that we are building internally, so, for example, we're having a huge overhaul of journalism tools over the past at least 5 years. I think it started long before I joined. And we work with those teams throughout. So we've talked a lot from inception until delivery. We work with the developers, the designers, and it goes through sort of stints and phases, because sometimes they'll come to us with concepts and we give them feedback and we have a bit of a discussion, like, what are you trying to achieve? Could we do it this way? What about that way? And then they might go away, you know, for a few months, bash their heads together, develop it, you know, come back to us and say, now can you test it for us? Is this having the desired effect? And then the flip side to that is, that's things that we develop ourselves, but equally, even for smaller things, if we want to use it as part of the authorization side of things, it needs to come via our team to be tested, to be approved. And if there are any issues, we then work with those teams. It's not just a case of blanket no. It's a case of writing clear reports, having conversations, and helping point them in the direction of how to fix it. I'm going to say very quickly as well, when we're buying systems in, that's a whole other kettle of fish, but we have now got a very robust procurement process. So again, accessibility is one of the mandatory questions that is always included now in a procurement, just like security, just like legal, just like all those other things that businesses consider essential. Accessibility is now up there. And worst case scenario, we do have the power to sort of veto a supplier, so they could be knocked out just on that basis. So it's been given the weight and the attention that I think we'd all agree here it deserves.
Got a good cheer. Excellent. Is that something that's also being discussed within the TV project, Ellie? So procurement and, you know, making sure that the staff is able to access.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I said before, that's something that Natalie and Jonathan are actually involved in, is how we can work together and have that collective voice, you know, our members, between all 10 of them, have a huge amount of spending power. So if you are creating technology that is inaccessible, then we don't want our members to be buying it. So that is something that we're currently in the process of looking at how we can collaborate and put together some really clear guidance on that. And making sure all of the technology that, you know, there's programs like, they're such specific programs. So if you're a script writer, you use something called Final Draft. And only in the past year has that become accessible for screen readers. It's finally had an easy read version of it. So how, as an industry, can we make sure all of these key pieces of technology we use aren't preventing people from having a successful career within our industry?
That's great. And one of the things that we talk about quite often when we talk about TV and broadcasting is sports. So RNIB has done a tremendous amount of work in the past few years making sure, you know, broadcast sports is accessible. We used to hear that, you know, you've got radio commentary that's accessible. Actually, when you start looking at into it and you start talking to people who listen to radio commentary, what you get is that radio commentary is not accessible. It's written from the point of view of a sighted listener who's seen the pitch, who understands the gameplay. So we've worked with Jonathan, we've worked with lots of different broadcasters, making sure that there is a set of best practice on how you make that different games accessible. But talking about the in-stadium experience, John, what are the Rangers doing to make that in-stadium experience more accessible, more enjoyable for someone with sight loss?
In terms of the commentary, there's we have four commentators who have been doing it for at least 25 years, and they're based on the media gantry along with all the TV companies. Each of the people who attend the match are provided with a transmitter and a set of headphones, and I've listened into their commentaries, and they commentate on, you get the excitement of the game, but they're very specific about the positions on the pitch and how they relate to other people. It's just a different, and as you said, it's delivered to accommodate people with visual impairments to provide them the information to be able to build that picture, and it's fantastic. There was a feature on STV about it last year. And it's hugely successful, and it's replicated at the other team that I'm not allowed to mention, but the because the Rex Blind Party came from the old Blindcraft factories, and there was a guy called his name was actually Rex, and he helped set up these two supporters clubs, and the Celtic still have the equivalent at Parkhead as well. But yeah, they've been going for over 50 years. People come there, know exactly where they're going, they know exactly what they're going to get. It's accessible as it can be for them. We're looking to build on it. They are provided with a specific area in the stadium, but there are other people with visual impairments around the stadium who utilise the service as well. We're looking to expand on that with proper an internet connection within the stadium, but currently we're still using an analog system, which slightly limits it.
I think there's a lot of innovation happening with sort of in live sport at the moment. So we've come across this action audio, which is augmented audio. If you're watching tennis, I know it was at Wimbledon last year, and they're doing it again this time. I think it's going to be on BBC and live at Wimbledon. So exciting things. Talking about augmented audio, Lindsay, I'm going to come to you. I know we're doing exciting things together. So do you want to talk about how user input is actually influencing the best practice that you're developing for mixed reality?
Yeah, sure. So I'm kind of representing the game side of things here, which has come a long way in terms of accessibility over the last few years. So certainly over the past couple of days, I know that people have mentioned games to me like the Last of Us Part 2, which won loads of accessibility awards. There was Lego Star Wars as well, which won a number of awards a few years ago. What we've been focusing on is virtual reality, and you know that links to extended reality, mixed reality, So it covers all the different types of headsets. But essentially, the games technology is not just being used for playing games, it's being used in leisure and cultural experiences as well. So how best do you design for users that have different needs? Quite often, what we've seen in the past in the games industry is that users with visual impairments are brought in far too late into the testing process, and accessibility is kind of seen as a bolt-on at the end, which it's not. It needs to be considered throughout the development phase. So what we've been doing is looking at the existing literature for our little prototype that we have to see how we can best augment virtual reality experiences that might be placed in a museum to explain how the scenario works for visually impaired users. So I don't know if, I think some people in the room here have tried out the little demo that I've had out in the marketplace. But essentially, giving users freedom to customise the experience to suit their needs. So whether it be, choosing the volume of the voiceover, the types of voice that you want to guide you. Certainly my team at Aberdee, we tried the built-in voices with the software engine that we used, and we found it to be quite horrific, to be honest. It was rather robotic, and we wanted something that was a bit more natural, so it was like just a person was guiding you. And that's where AI technology has been particularly useful. We managed to get some more human sound and voices built into our little games experience. But aside from that as well, we looked to see what else we could include. So adjusting text size, adjusting contrast, high contrast modes, for example. The other thing that we looked into, so not just catering for people that might have visual impairments, but perhaps physical impairments as well. We decided that we just wanted everything head controlled, so there was no need for additional controllers, for example. So all movements are controlled by just small head movements to make the process as easy as possible to use. So it's important to actually speak to people that have had that lived experience. One thing that I've said to a few people at the stand that have come and spoke to me is that when we looked at existing literature, a lot of publications out there that were designing for visually impaired people, they actually didn't test with them. In some cases, they just tested among themselves, tested with students, or put on blindfolds and used that as a simulation for visual impairment, which is just not the same. So in our case, this is kind of the pilot stage that we're at, but we're now looking to actually test this with visually impaired users to get some additional feedback to see how we can improve these experiences.
I think one of the most heartbreaking moments for me was back in 2017 when RNIB was funded by the European Commission to work on virtual reality, how you make virtual reality accessible. It was almost taken for granted that you could add audio description. Just add audio description and you could make it accessible. I think what people need to understand is audio description is one of the ways. It's got limitations, and it's only one of the ways in which you can make media accessible. You need to actually understand what is the experience that you want the viewer to have. Is it a shared experience? Is it an individual experience? What device they're going to be watching it on? I know that level of personalization is not always possible, but that's something that we need to keep in mind. I'm very aware of, very conscious of the time, so not sure if there are any questions from the audience. There we go. We've got one hand up right there.
Hi there, Stephen Davidson, RNIB. This question mostly for Natalie Curran. I was really impressed with the BBC's approach to accessibility, because many organisations still seem to struggle with procurement of systems that aren't fully accessible for staff who are visually impaired. What led to this buy-in from the BBC that other organisations might be able to emulate?
I think, to be fair, the accessibility sort of desire or best intentions have been there for a long time, sort of before I joined, so I can't really speak to what started that. But I joined the BBC about 4.5 years ago, about 6 months actually, after our new Director-General, Tim Davey, and it was this big strategy of accessible first. And we, when I joined the team at the same time as a colleague, and we were going through the procurement process and saying, we're asking these accessibility questions, but it all felt very loose and fluffy, and sometimes you got, you know, good answers, sometimes it was considered, sometimes it was weighted. And we really, we sat down with the head of procurement and we just really, really looked at it, like, this is not fit for purpose, how can we do this? Because apart from anything else, it's hypocritical. You can't hold your own developers and design team to a set of standards, and at the moment it's WCAG, so Web Content Accessibility Guidelines 2.2, level AA, it's a mouthful. We can't be holding them to standards and then be procuring stuff that's not fit for purpose. And, I mean, some of the answers I get are quite funny. Like, I've had one answer which was, there's no audio or video content, so it's not relevant. And I was like, well, unless you're doing it through telepathy, it is relevant. but I think it was just, it's a case of there's a growing recognition that, as I say, if we want to have more, be more representative of the population, if we want to employ more staff with disabilities, our systems need to be accessible. We are, apart from anything else, chartered, obligated to buy in some of those systems, so therefore they have to be accessible. So it was one begot the other, but it wasn't easy, and it's still there's still tweaks to be ironed out, but it's a lot better than I think anything else we've seen anywhere else. So yeah, we are proud of it.
We should be really proud of the research culture at BBC, because it's open research, which helps the industry and supports the industry's requirements as well. We rely quite often on the BBC R&D to do some essential research work, and they're always up for it. So that's it's absolutely commendable. Any
Can
other
I just
questions?
Yes, add a quick, of course. Sorry, it's Jonathan from Channel 4. I think just a quick additional point that I guess feels relevant to this, the topics we've been talking about today. I think there are a lot of areas where the big broadcasters do try and be in competition, like, you know, bums on seats on a Saturday night, for example, and how many people get reported watching certain programmes. But I think for this kind of topic, you know, it's really important to reinforce that point that we do collaborate, like there is, you know, through TAP and through the kind of work stream that Natalie and I are involved in about, you know, taking something like those procurement exercises and trying to share the knowledge and share the kind, you know, work towards maybe even a standard or something around like setting that kind of bar of accessibility in procurement exercises. There's also, I think, you know, because TV is so like, you know, there's a lot of short kind of freelance fixed term productions, there's often, you know, accessibility solutions that are found and then they might not be captured anywhere, they might be lost after that production ends. And I think one of the other resources that Natalie and I are kind of supporting putting together is a sort of catalogue almost of like, you know, accessible solutions that might include things like communication aids or, you know, bits of software that you could use on a production that are accessible, but also thinking about hardware, like, you know, one of the examples is like a camera. It's like the first camera that can be fully operated by a wheelchair user. So it's thinking about that kind of the challenges to a, you know, mobile like production work environment, but how different sort of facets of accessibility kind of interact with that as well. So I just wanted to reinforce that we're not really rivals. We are all kind of working towards the same goals when it comes to kind of accessibility.
Friendly competition.
Darren's got a question.
There we go. Let's try that. Oh, hello. There we go. Thank you. Hi there, Darren. So in the spirit of friendly competition, I've got a sort of a question. I suppose, John, this might be particularly for you. I'm coming at this from my experience as a football fan. Obviously, about 50% of all football games are away games. So I'm wondering to what extent there is a kind of a spirit of collaboration among football clubs in Scotland. And I'm also wondering if there could be an appetite, kind of taking inspiration from the TV access goal of fully accessible and inclusive TV by 2030, of setting a similar goal for football so that any supporter of any club in England or Scotland, but let's start with Scotland because that's where we are, can go to any stadium and enjoy a fully inclusive, descriptive commentary experience from any seat, near instantaneous, regardless of where they are in the stadium and which team they're supporting.
Excellent question, Darren.
Yeah, the green tie on, I knew that was going to be trouble. Yeah, it's a good question. We have a network of disability access officers across all of these Scottish football clubs. As you'll be aware, though, they're different, very different sizes, the various clubs across Scotland. There's only really two what you would call big clubs, I suppose. Maybe four or five, sort of maybe just slightly below that. And a lot of clubs who have very limited resources, but they do all have disability access officers. I have to say that it's a bit hit and miss with some of the away, because I attend all of the away games, obviously to support all disabled supporters when we travel. And probably half of the teams in the Premier League provide audio descriptive commentaries. We've offered to bring our own commentators to away games. In answer to your further question, we have a very active network, and we work in the SFA have just appointed a national disability access officer to drive forward the sort of standards in across the country. But there is a big commitment from wider UEFA, the European regulator. They've produced a set of standards called Accessiball. This is actually the Accessiball. It's brilliant, isn't it? It used to be the Cafe Week of Action at the Centre for Accessible Football in Europe, but they've produced a set of standards, and they have a Cafe Week of Action, and this is actually part of it. The Week of Action actually is happening just now from the 7th to the 23rd of March. Yep, you might notice the obvious mistake there. It's 2.5 weeks long. But they've produced a detailed set of accessibility guidelines, which I've developed an accessibility strategy for Rangers based on those guidelines and also other sort of legal requirements in this country, the Green Guide for Accessible Stadia. In answer to your question, there is a drive Europe-wide, and they've set minimum standards that clubs need to reach. So, for instance, there's a recognition of minimum standards and minimum facilities and services that every club has to provide if they're going to participate in Europe. Obviously, that doesn't apply to quite a lot of teams in Scotland. So, anyway, long waffling answer to your question. Yeah, there is a drive towards that, and I totally agree with you that, you know, we want to make the services as accessible to all supporters, disabled supporters, and specifically supporters with visual impairments across all clubs in Scotland. But it's not the case at the moment, I'd have to say.
Thank you very much, John. Darren, I'm not sure if you tried the UEFA app last year, which had the audio description for every game. I'm going to come and talk to you about it in a while. Any other questions? Otherwise, we can... Okay, we've got one in the front. Okay,
Hi there. So this is just a question about kind of giving feedback, really. So with a lot of these big TV providers or like Channel 4 or the BBC, obviously you have a contact us form. You try and describe what the problem is, and then you get a general reply, oh, yeah, we'll look into it. I wonder, do you guys have any current solutions for how an easily findable contact details to give you that kind of feedback, very accurate, kind of very specific accessibility issues, and if not, like what would be your advice for kind of like given that specific feedback, no matter what industry it's in? It's like these multinationals or an issue that could involve multiple departments.
Thanks. It's a good question. I think I've got a couple of thoughts, I guess. Firstly, like, specifically on contacting broadcasters, I guess there are, you know, I know that ITV do now have a kind of dedicated, like, accessibility mailbox that is for kind of accessibility and access services, kind of specific queries where you are, you know, I'm sure a lot of people who work in big companies with big kind of your inquiry centres will appreciate that kind of, you know, some for all the guides and the kind of, you know, pre-planned sort of, you know, paths of that you can write out for people. Often these, you know, inboxes are managed by teams that maybe don't have first-hand experience of those specific systems and issues and stuff. So I think, you know, that's something that we're definitely looking into, is to like having a kind of a dedicated mailbox. I think obviously it's also really important just, you know, pointing out that contacting in a range of different ways as well, like whether it's call, whether it's a form, whether it's sign language as well. But also I think, you know, if you think it is an issue that kind of has a much broader application, then there's always, you know, working with, you know, kind of bodies like RNIB, other kind of stakeholder groups as well, because you are probably not the only person in that situation. So, you know, having that, I think, like, one of the speakers yesterday talking about, you know, I'm not saying necessarily invoke the UN human rights kind of, you know, but leaning on the legislation that's there as well is a really good way of kind of, you know, supporting an issue that you're having. Also, plug, because there's been a few announcements, we're you know, at Channel 4 looking forward to kind of working with the RNIB on a dedicated kind of workshop around audio description as well, which is more around kind of editorial and quality matters than kind of platform issues. And I think potentially you might be talking about kind of digital accessibility issues, but it's just kind of that continued process, like so many speakers today have alluded to, of like keeping in touch with your users and making sure that you're kind of refining whatever nature of service that you're offering to people, but kind of keeping that dialogue open and, you know, being able to kind of iteratively move it in the, you know, in a forward direction, I think is so important.
If I can jump in quickly as well, just say we might not have a dedicated mailbox, but if a complaint comes in, for example, to the BBC and it mentions accessibility or anything to do with it, it gets flagged to the accessibility team that handles sort of audience-facing and external-facing products and stuff. So it does get handled by them, and you might not get a specific response, and I can't speak to why that is. It might be a case of volume, but it is being flagged up to the right people and it is being looked at. And equally, it was mentioned, I think just in the previous panel, about using social media. So I think it was actually the RNIB posted on, or tweeted, or X, whatever the flip you call it now, on that platform, saying it's really brilliant that BBC are now audio describing strictly. What a shame they posted all their pictures without alt text. That was a social media blunder. Somebody was obviously very excited and forgot. But that was very quickly picked up, and I think that issue rectified within about half an hour. So these things, you know, hashtag BBC, hashtag accessibility, whatever it is, they are monitored, they will be flagged up.
I'll just add one more line. This is a very, very, it's a very hot topic at the moment, and it is something that RNIB always includes in our consultation responses, whether it's to Ofcom or it's to any of the broadcasters. There needs to be a consistent approach on how do you log your feedback? Because we need to keep end users at the very core of all conversations. So thank you for bringing that up. I'm sorry, it's time to wrap it up. A big applause for the panelists. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your conference.